My name is Sue Lin. I am, as Gloria mentioned, I'm with the Health Resources and Services Administration. Within HRSA, I met with the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. The survey that you have heard presented this afternoon, the National Survey for Children Health and the National Survey for Children with Special Health Care Needs, are important points of pride for our Bureau, so it's a privilege to sit with all of the panelists. The particular question I'm going to be answering this afternoon is examining the relationship between emergency room visits of children with neurodevelopmental disabilities and access to services and family financial hardships taken from the 2005 and 2006 National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs. I have no relationship to disclose. I want to acknowledge the folks that were very instrumental in bringing me this question and helping me take a look at this question. This question was brought to me the week between Christmas and New Year's. I had volunteered to be the acting division director while other folks were on vacation during that time, thinking that I would be very quiet and that I would have time to finish up all of my paperwork. But as information requests come in, it sends the Bureau staff into a frenzy. after we were able to finish the package to submit, for the information request, we sat down and started chatting, and Dr. Teria Jerm had asked me a question. She was a former ER doctor with specialized in children with special health care needs as a result of fame that she had gathered around the Philadelphia area as a ER provider that was sensitive to families with children with special health care needs. And she had a lot of anecdotal information about families that she was never able to quantify. And so I said, well, why don't we take a look at what our national surveys can elucidate. And then Ben Margolis, he helped with the literature review and helping us think through those questions, because there's not a lot of literature out there around emergency room use and children with neurodevelopmental disability. And then my division director, Dr. Stella Yu, she provided the mentorship and the guidance on the analyses. Okay. A little bit of background significance. As I said, there's a paucity of literature for children with neurodevelopmental disabilities and their emergency department use. But this is what we know right now. One, that emergency department healthcare professionals often care for pediatric patients with mental health emergencies and children that include children with neurodevelopmental disabilities. Parents with young children often seek care in emergency departments for non-urgent conditions. When their pediatrician cannot be reached quickly. So approximately 40% of those ER visits are for non-urgent care, and this is a problem for healthcare. Heavy emergency department users typically have significant health needs and face barriers to receiving other kinds of care, and the emergency department overcrowding is a problem that threatens the safety and the public health of the patients. I want to go over some of the case definitions I use. You've heard the other panelists talk about how they narrowed down the population that they took a look at. As I said, there's a paucity of literature, so we really couldn't go to the literature and establish a categorization for emergency department use frequency. So looking at the literature, we made a decision to dichotomize emergency department use to 0 and 2 emergency department use and 3 or more category. So this comes from the question within the survey that asks the number of visits, and literally it's during the past 12 months, how many times has a subject child visited a hospital emergency room, and then enter the number of visits by the respondent. Within the children with neurodevelopmental disabilities, you've also heard the other panelists talk about some of the condition-specific questions that the survey asks. So within the neurodevelopmental definition that established for this paper includes the parents who positively responded to whether their children had attention deficit disorder, autism, Down syndrome, mental retardation, cerebral palsy, and muscular dystrophy. The core outcomes, I think some of you are maybe very familiar with the 6 core outcomes that MCHB has developed for children with special health care needs, especially looking at how these core outcomes measure the progress towards a comprehensive and family-centered systems of care for children with special health care needs. The particular one that I'm going to look at today, access to care, comes from the core outcome number 2, which is children and youth with special health care needs receive coordinated, ongoing, comprehensive care within a medical home. In terms of the financial problem, those questions actually have been well covered by my previous panelists, in that the financial hardships are using the questions that talk about child's health care has caused financial problems, family members stop working due to the child's health, family members have cut work hours to care for children, and family needed additional income for the child's medical expenses. So I set out to have 2 objectives. One is examine the association between frequency of emergency department use and parental report of access to care for children with neurodevelopmental disabilities. And the second objective was to examine the association between frequency of emergency department use and financial hardship for families with children with neurodevelopmental disabilities. Several of my panelists have already gone over the survey, that it's cross-sectional, nationally representative. I wanted to let you know that the sample size of the children that I was able to pull out of the data set was a total of 15,238. Approximately 1,475 had 3 or more emergency department use, and there were kids aged 17 or younger. So I conducted both a bivariate analysis of emergency department use with and social demographic variables, access to service, financial hardship, and then I also did a multivariate logistic regression to examine the associations, while controlling for individual level social demographic variables such as insurance status, race, ethnicity, family structure, gender, and child's age. Let me go over the results of the social demographic characteristic of children with neurodevelopmental disabilities. Within the race and ethnicity category, about 27% of non-Hispanic Black children with neurodevelopmental disabilities at 3 or more emergency department use, as compared to 15.7 in the 0 to 2 EDU category. And you'll see that reverse for non-Hispanic whites. Where this for the 0 to 2 emergency department use for the non-Hispanic whites was 67.4%, and then for 3 or more, it went down to 50.5%. On the insurance type, more children with neurodevelopmental disabilities on public insurance had 3 or more EDUs. That's consistent with the literature that individuals on public insurance tend to use the emergency room more often. And then finally, in terms of age group, more children with neurodevelopmental disability age 0 to 5 years old had 3 or more emergency department use. And that is also consistent with the literature, where younger children, they tend to have more complex health needs that the parents are going to, accessing the emergency room for those services. In terms of access to care, there is multiple components that comprise of the core outcome, number 2, for what MCHB has defined as children receiving coordinated, ongoing, comprehensive care within a medical home. And those individual components include, 1, that the doctors are usually, the doctors make families feel like a partner. Family is satisfied with the service that they receive. The child has a usual health care source. The child has a usual source of preventative care. The child receives effective care coordination, and families get sufficient help in coordinating care. Doctors listen carefully, and they're sensitive to the values and customs of the family, as well as providing the needed information at each of the visits. The ones that are highlighted in red and underlined are the ones with significance when I did the adjusted odds ratios. And you'll see that it is all decreasing odds for each of these components that comprise of their access to a comprehensive and coordinated medical home. So the issues is, you know, whether or not primary care is doing its job to provide support to those families. This particular table is looking at the adjusted odds ratios for children with neurodevelopmental disabilities and 3 or more emergency room visits and family financial difficulty. Within this table, you'll see that it's pretty clear that for those families with children with neurodevelopmental disability with 3 or more emergency visits, they're twice as likely to have children's health problem. Healthcare has caused a financial problem. More than twice, family member stopped working due to child's health. Also, similarly, families need additional income for child medical care. So increased, you know, emergency department use is positively associated with all of these factors that are answering the questions of financial difficulties within the survey. This particular table is looking at bodily difficulties within this group of folks and taking a look at whether they had the parents reported activity or participation difficulties or emotional behavioral difficulties. So we do see that parents who reported positively for each of these areas, the bodily difficulties, activity participation difficulties, and emotional behavioral difficulties are more likely to have the three or more emergency department use. So moving on to discussion. So I think from the results, it was a pretty clear picture to me that there were significant barriers to access to care. There is a health disparity issue that may be looking at some of the race and ethnic disparities that could be happening within the communities. And then also families receiving public insurance. Why is it that they are using more emergency departments ER rooms more. And then this challenges, this dimension of challenges and financial hardship, you know, are families experiencing this downward spiral in economic status as they're paying more out-of-pocket expenses or they're having to stop work and suffering these financial consequences, leading them to having to access the emergency room because of some additional barriers to accessing their primary care doctors. So some strategies for reduction of EDU that we have started to think about is whether or not we can provide supports to parents with young children with neurodevelopmental disabilities in the management of complex health care conditions. Also, whether or not providing community supports to parents accessing available public benefits and services and financial planning would be helpful in supporting families going through this situation. Whether or not providing access to assistive technology services for children with physical difficulties may also help in the support of this. And then also clinical provider education and training to enhance supporting families of children with neurodevelopmental disabilities. Now, I'm going to sort of take a mental leap here because I usually do that. On September 24th, I transitioned to a different position within HRSA to the Bureau of Health, Bureau of Primary Health Care. We fund all of the federally qualified health centers across the country. There's 1,200 of them at this point. This is probably the only bureau that I've been I've been in state government, now in federal government, where the budget keeps increasing in a tough economic climate. So I'm very excited at the fact that there's additional resources, but I'm also trying to figure out how can disability community be at the table for this discussion. So I do feel like there needs to be an optimization of healthcare, as a broader policy implication of this the paper, going through this paper, and there is a large support implementation of a patient-centered medical home in primary care because this particular goal of getting federally qualified health care to receive patient-centered medical home recognition is a Secretary Sebelius goal, explicitly serving the vulnerable population. So if we have this directive, how do we better support our families, children with neurodevelopmental disabilities to receive primary care in these federally qualified health centers that are, whether we like it or not, are going to expand as a result of the Affordable Care Act? Also, what does the role of electronic health record play in facilitating the coordination among primary care and specialty care serving the children with neurodevelopmental disabilities? The federal government has poured incredible amounts of resources into federally qualified health centers to purchase electronic health records and implement electronic health records. How can they be best to serve the disability communities and the families that require this coordination? And then the future directions, some of my thoughts is identifying the leading cause of emergency department visits for children with neurodevelopmental disability, and then looking at developing a categorization of frequency of EDU for the neurodevelopmental population to better measure impact. A couple of strengths and limitations. One, that this was an exploratory analysis focused on children with neurodevelopmental disabilities in emergency department use, identifying access to care issues for children with higher frequencies of EDU. I think some of the biases are already covered by my previous panelists and also the survey limitations. And I want to just reiterate about the policy questions that I posed to all of you, and hoping that you'll help me think about how I can get some of your thoughts on the new role that I'm in, and then providing some information to the network of federally qualified health centers to develop some anticipatory guidance and community support for that can benefit these families and the broader disability community as well. So that's my contact information, and thank you very much for hanging in there until the very end.
Thank you all, four really talented researchers really demonstrating the value of the data set and helping us start to ask some really important questions. First one relating to physical activity, screen time, and obesity. The second one really disentangling what really is critical around financial burden or perceived financial burden and healthcare needs. Third one, I had it. Healthcare transition, adolescent, ASD, that's right, and looking to see how that group compares with some of the other groups, and then Sue Lynn really examining emergency department use and relating that to quality of care. All really important questions that I know many of you are also working on or have probably been thinking about. We're going to open it up for questions now. And if it's to a particular person, would you just so indicate? And use the mic. Do we know if this mic is working? Thanks, Steve. Not so much, huh? If we want to get started with questions, I'll repeat them. Any questions for our folks up front?
UDS Uniform Data System is the data collection system that that we have at the Bureau of Primary Health Care that requires submission from the federally qualified health centers every year. And yes, it is taking over my life as we speak. I really appreciate your comments about access to evening care, the pediatric wait time. I think those are all things that we're considering because we need to have a better way of addressing if we're investing in additional clinics, whether or not, one of the questions that we come across is whether or not providing evening hours can serve this particular population better, or do we need to open up two clinic sites with similar hours? And so those are, I don't know that we've come up with a good algorithm to make that decision yet. At this point, it's sort of been on a project officer basis. And so if you have any thoughts on, you know, how can we better accommodate and provide access to people, I would love to have more conversation with you. I am fully taking advantage of that. Thank you so much.
Additional questions? Let me ask, oh, Steve, go for it. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask Lauren Wisk a question about, I'm normally a proponent of using subjective measures, but as you were talking and then afterwards I kept on thinking of going through this in my mind, is it a problem that you're using a subjective measure of kind of, I don't know if it's really a subjective measure of foregone or delayed care. And is that because of cost? Did you only use, if they said because of cost?
So in this analysis I did, and I've broken it up since then, but this is actually collapsing across any unmet healthcare need. And I mean, I imagine that the question in the survey specifically asked for you to list your primary reason. And so I imagine that there's also going to be situations where maybe someone won't say that, oh, cost was the main reason, but it could be a secondary reason. So I started out by looking at altogether, just any unmet health care
right.
And I have since, and the relationships, as you might imagine, get stronger when you isolate just those who say it was due to cost.
Right. Well, my concern is that the subjective financial burden is, it seems to me that's a rather similar question to the four. I mean, if you said that you had, if you'd already said that you'd foregone services for your kid because of cost, wouldn't you come to almost automatically say that there was a burden associated with that, and similarly the other way around? I mean, I'm slightly accusing you of, you know, having some tautology in your analysis, but I mean, the real concern, I guess, is that you might be controlling away some of the effect by putting in a variable that's a little too similar to your outcome variable.
Yeah, and I think that your point is really well taken, and I was actually surprised because I thought about your point is really well taken, and I was actually surprised when I looked at just some of the crosstabs, and that it doesn't really map on where there's, you know, very much concordance between people who report subjective burden and unmet healthcare need due to cost. There are some people who report having unmet healthcare need due to cost, and yet no subjective burden. And one of the things that, and my dissertation specifically focuses on this idea of how do we measure burden in a meaningful way. And I'm actually using the MEPS, the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, because it gives me longitudinal nature, and so I can kind of separate out the timing, which helps to address that issue a little bit. And also, I'm trying to focus more on using the objective measures, but acknowledging the fact that this later foregone care variable is essentially the subjective outcome that takes into account the perception of unmet healthcare need, and use those two variables, just the total cost relative to family income, but then predicting the outcome to kind of see where, you know, the cut point, where do families delay for foregone care, and taking into account some of the other variables that might influence that.
Any other questions? I have one if people want to think a little bit. And it really struck me with Juhi, your presentation, but some of the other ones as well. I think maybe Nancy and Lauren as well. I'm less aware of that with you, Sue. About when you looked at the unadjusted odds ratios, you were finding a number of things, and then you co-varied on many, many of the factors, and we start to lose some things. Part of the chair's forum discussion yesterday, and certainly HP 2020, really starting to take much more of a determinants perspective. What, if you were to be thinking about some of your findings within a social determinants perspective, where maybe you're trying to understand the impact or the interaction of impacts, how would you have gone about that, or what your thoughts about that?
Because I get, you know, all these increased prevalence in HLDS2 children using special tribal care, they are actually more obese. They are more sedentary. They are what you want to eat is true, but tonight I was more this SDS basically SDS, and so parents, their old physical activity, kind of, you know, you guys work their families, they are in particular parents, whose parents are not active, kids are not active. So basically just the type of care matter, what kind of sort of condition they have doesn't matter, because their parents, what kind of environment they present to their children, influence more of these health behaviors and obesity. And also, I think that the neighborhood impact of, so that's okay, you know, the family condition is more important than physical, special health care needs they have. So that's why the, okay, so again, it's social treatment. So,
you know, that's why I got unmotivated.
Any other comments, Matt?
Oh, yes. You know, I think in my analysis, those complex conditions, the additional conditions, mm-hmm. so some of these youth had 4 and 5 conditions, and so that sort of is overpowering everything else. So the parents and the youth are just trying to deal with maintaining a level of health and surviving in the moment, and they're not thinking about the additional need into adulthood. And so I think that that's where sort of our issues are lying, and mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's perceived need and perceived receipt of these services. So focusing on parent report, I'm not going to get a lot better. We have looked at, we did some additional analysis and have conducted some focus groups with parents and youth with ASD to really get at a better feel for where are they at and what do they need to make this transition happen in a more mm-hmm. realistic mm-hmm. way. And I presented a poster on that yesterday, but it's mm-hmm. really, they're wrapped up in education and vocational services, mm-hmm. and this takes a far backseat. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. It did raise a related question. I was trying to link the two presentations together as well. When we look at the adult data, and that really is on unmet need because due to cost, the numbers are more like 28% for adults. So the was it 8% or something for youth? But it did speak to the need for. It may feel tough now, but it's probably going to feel tougher. How do we start to factor that into empowering youth to get what they're going to need? Anybody want to tackle that one?
That's my life work. No.
It will be.
Yes, absolutely. I think we have to start early. And in writing this paper up, that was one of my big advocacies is we've got to start at least at 12 and keep going with that. And I got a lot of pushback from reviewers saying, no, that's too early. They're not thinking about healthcare transition. And the pediatrics providers really say, no, it's not. If it's going to get done, we've got to start early. And we have to empower them to think that this is important and ask for it themselves. Our youth with ASD really do have goals and aspirations, and it's our job to help them get the tools to make those into a reality and a mm-hmm. realistic goal and find action steps to make that happen.
I think one other important point to consider is the fact that, you know, these children aren't isolated in their healthcare experience. You know, their, especially children with special healthcare needs, their healthcare needs can influence the healthcare needs of their family members. And you want to think about spillover. And just because maybe the child that is, you know, captured in the survey didn't report unmet healthcare need doesn't mean that there's not another child in that family or an adult parent who experienced the burden, took the burden on themselves in place of the child. And just because, again, that child didn't personally experience it doesn't mean they're going to not see some ripple effects that come from the higher unmet healthcare need for their family as a whole. And so I think it's important also to consider that just, you know, one point in time that we're capturing may not be an accurate reflection of fully what it is that they're experiencing.
Well, I was just going to add one quick thing, because I think things may change because of the coverage of the healthcare coverage of kids being extended beyond. And so we may see something different, or just a delayed transition, or additional time for people to prepare for that transition. And I don't know if that will also impact the results that we'll see in a couple of years.
You think about being covered to age?
Right, right, yeah.
And hopefully the quality will improve with the Affordable Care Act. There are going to be a lot of additional compensation for quality improvements and providing more services, so I'm really hopeful that that's going to sort of make a paradigm shift with some of our providers that say that quality matters, and that's really what we should be thinking about.
Question?
I think two parts. One is that pediatric care and the focus on children's mental health care needs is rather family focused, and your child works within a community. You have family at school, and there's a lot of support designed for children. And then when you transition, whatever that may be, whether it's 18, 21, 25, 26, whatever, or whatever the teacher says, you're adult now, and I don't have you anymore. Internal medicine is not designed for you to be a member of a community with support. It's, you know, adult care is less time, it's problem focused, it's one problem at a time usually. And so you're taking, I think that as an adult, we provide very good care to children who have special health care needs. We've gotten to a point where we have no place to send them because we don't have manpower or adult providers who were educated or trained to do that.
Robbie, could you identify yourself in the nature of work that you do? Because you really work life course in some regards, right?
Yeah, so I'm Robbie Urbans, and I work at Immunity Center for Portland, Oregon, and we do wound tissue care. And so a lot of the time, when we try to do this about one of the issues that nationwide affiliate is pediatrics, care of young until whenever, and then you want to push them off to adult hematology. I mean, really, you can send them there, but that's internal medicine. Adult medicine is not geared towards comprehensive care or multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary care. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that may have happened after a brain injury or with involved disability, like, you know, that's I think that's just, we've done a good job. We've outlived prognosis for when Title V disorders have been identified. And then they're called Title V, and then we don't have a Title V-15.
Title 85.
We don't have that. And I think the other thing that happens on the physical activity of adults is that for a lot of our families, if you have more than one disorder or you know more than one diagnosis, the burden on the family, whether it's extra work or you have other children and stuff, is that it's hard for parents to be active. Just trying to catch up. So you have financial burden, so depending on where you live, maybe now you're not doing this, you know, you're scrambling,
yeah.
And you're providing for your kids. So to be physically active, when we talk to people that are you physically active, the better off you are and the more secure you are, then you're more able to quantify whether they can go for a walk with everybody. But if you have these burdens, because the support's not there, and that's hard for the families to go out.
Thank you. Any other questions, including any suggestions? It's rarely that you will ever hear the federal government ask for input on a program that really has money. So, all right then. I'll thank all of you for coming and, as we've said, staying. And another round of applause for our presenters.